that first gig that I had was playing in a jazz trio. It was piano, bass, and drums. We used to play at a restaurant called the Lobster Pot in Cleveland.
Nice.
And, you know, so, I mean, that was
come see me at the pot.
Right, yeah, exactly. Hey, you know, come see this 16-year-old kid play at the pot. Right. Yeah.
This is the Life's Learning Curve podcast, and I'm Paul Hart.
Stand by.
Today we're here at Studio 502. We have Robert Brose here, currently drumming here in the Midwest for the country band Smoking Guns and the Doobie Brothers tribute band China Grove. For the past 30 years, Robert's been a freelance artist, a church musician, as well as maintaining a good-sized private teaching practice. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Paul. Thank you. thank you for having me today.
Nice of you to come today. You play multiple instruments, and I know that you began on piano. Is that right?
Correct. Yep.
So how did it go from piano to drums?
Well, I had always wanted to play drums, and I was one of those kids that, you know, dragged out the pots and pans from, you know, underneath the cabinets. Yeah. But in my house growing up, piano was mandatory, wasn't an option. So for both myself and my sisters, we had to take piano. My mom was very musical. She played piano. Her mom played piano. My dad didn't play an instrument, but loved music. So there was always music in the house. I started taking piano lessons in second grade. Wanted to play drums, but the school didn't offer lessons until fifth grade. Right. Yeah. So I had that piano background when I first started playing drums. And then when I started taking drum lessons, I had to continue with the piano. The piano has benefited me greatly. I mean, it's made me a better, not only drummer, but a better musician. Interesting side note to that. So the whole piano thing, I remember it as clear as day. You know, I would sit down at the piano and my mom would have me practice.
Yeah.
And I would sit there and not play a note.
Yeah.
And she would just very calmly be like, you know, well, okay, you just have to sit there until your time is done. And I remember her mantra was, you know, one day you'll thank me for this. Flash forward years later, when I was living in Nashville.
Yeah.
I had got done practicing drums one night, but the piano thing was in my head. So it was probably about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. Mm. And I thought, you know, okay, time to make that call. So I called up my mom and I was like, Mom, this is the phone call you've been waiting for. Remember how you said one day I'd thank you for making me take piano lessons? Mm-hmm. Well, this is it. Thanks for, you know, making me stick with it, because it just, it allowed me to accelerate in a way that just wouldn't have
been
possible.
And understand what everybody else is kind of doing. So why Yamaha drums?
You know, when I was a kid, first into drums, I would get every drum catalog.
Yeah.
And just pour over the pages.
Do you still have them?
I don't, unfortunately.
I found mine about 2 weeks ago.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The first kit that I actually bought on my own, I saved up my paper route money and bought this big Ludwig Octoplus kit, you know. I mean, it had the, you know, four concert toms.
That's right.
Everything like
that,
you know. And so that was my kit for a long time. And again, I now flash forward and I'm down in Nashville. And in Nashville, obviously, there's so many musicians and many of whom don't make it. The pawn shops are filled, you know, with really top quality instruments, because there are so many people who are, didn't make it and they need a bus ticket back home.
It's
you know?
Actors in L.A.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I went into this particular pawn shop that I would frequent probably once or twice a week. And there was this Yamaha kit sitting there. It had a kick drum and four toms, and it was like $500. Mm-hmm. Now, new, that kit.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, right.
So I picked it up. Had always wanted this. It's a recording custom
yes.
brand, Birch Shells. And uh-huh. so I had always right. wanted that particular type of kit. It came in a color, quartz gray, that was rare.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up. And since that time, so this would have been back probably in 95 or 6 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I have, through eBay and, you know, different websites, picked up pretty much every configuration, so now I can make that drum kit into a double kick with
yeah.
I can do anything with it, and I the Yamaha quality of their hardware,
mm-hmm. they're durable. You
know, oh yeah, and it's all machined like that,
yeah.
In such a way that you know, I mean, I play a ton of shows a year,
mm-hmm.
and you know these. The kit holds up and they sound great.
What do you kind of lean towards? What do you like best? Do you like gigging out with the bands or the studio stuff?
You know, it's really two different animals, I think. I enjoy doing both. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Especially when you're playing a live show and you have a good crowd, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be, you know, like a huge crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes you'll play in front of thousands of people and they're just kind of there watching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you're playing in front of thousands of people and they're all interactive. And conversely, you know, sometimes you're playing in a small little club and there's 10 people there, but they're just 10 really energetic, active people, and you're having a great time. So the live thing, I really enjoy doing it, especially when there's that feedback from the audience, you know, and then the band picks up on that.
Mm-hmm.
The studio thing is a different animal, you know. I mean, you're there. Sometimes if you get hired by a client, you're there to play a specific part that they want to hear for their song.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to do that. You know, you have to adapt. Maybe an engineer, you know, wants to hear a particular sound out of your drum kit, so you might have to tune your drum kit or maybe mm-hmm. even play a different drum kit in order to get the sound that they want. So it's just it's just a different process that goes on in the studio,
yeah.
but it's equally as fulfilling when the final project, you know, comes out and you hear it and
the final mix.
And you're like, oh yeah, it was a part of that. Yeah, I did an album. I'm dating myself as well.
Not according to my son, who's 23. He right. still has albums and records.
Right. Yeah. There was a group I was with not long after I had moved up to Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and we did some live shows and ended up recording a record. That was a really good experience because it was a whole collaborative thing. We had a rehearsal space, and mm-hmm. so we were working on these songs for quite a while. Everyone was contributing, and then when we finally went into the studio, you know, we had a really good producer and a really good engineer and brought in some guest artists that really kind of filled out the record. I mean, it didn't really do much commercially, but it was a really, really fun project to be involved with.
So that's a common tale. I mean, there's some really good music out there that nobody's ever heard.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, when I was first started playing professionally, you know, 16 years old, I couldn't drive yet. My parents would have to, like, drive me to a show and then come back at, you know, 2 in the morning and pick me up from a show. So that was exciting, doing that at that age.
Yeah.
the first time I was really with a professional band and making my living doing it and playing out on the road, that was a really exciting time. You know, I was young. I was in my early 20s, and here I am. Huh.
Living the dream.
Yeah, so to speak, right?
Literally.
And now doing what I'm doing, I've been with Smoking Guns for, I want to say, about 13 or 14 years, which is the longest I've ever been involved in any project.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the best thing, I've got grandkids too.
Mm-hmm.
And they really gravitate towards the music and coming out to see me play. So like when...
Isn't that great?
Yeah. So like when I'm playing a show and I see my, you know... grandkids out there and they're watching grandpa play drums, you know, that's like I'm getting paid to do what I love to
right.
do, and here's my
I'm looking out and seeing my fam
and
the grandkids. Are you kidding me?
I mean, it really doesn't get any better than that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you mentioned about doing your first professional gig when you were 16. What happened in between fifth grade band and being 16 that got you to that point playing percussion or drums?
Yeah, I took lessons, mm-hmm. you know, so I was always taking lessons, and I had some great teachers. I had some great influences around me.
Mm-hmm.
My two older sisters were always playing music, and so that was in the 60s, so I'm listening to the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and I'm, you know, hearing all that kind of stuff. So I was big into rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure it was my 12th, 13th birthday. One of my sisters was dating a drummer, and he was like a jazz drummer. And so my sister, for my birthday, bought me a record by a drummer named Elvin Jones.
Okay.
I had never heard anybody... Yeah. play drums like that.
I mean,
mind blown.
Coming from rock and roll, and then you hear a jazz drummer. Yeah, that's different.
And so I call it my jazz snob phase. I took my Led Zeppelin records and Rolling Stone records, and back then you know you had all these used record stores, and so I went and I traded all my records in for, you know, Art Blakey records and Miles Davis records and John Coltrane records, and I just got immersed in the whole jazz thing. Another drum set story. So there was a music store back in Cleveland that, you know, I would frequent. I remember the guy telling me, you know, I've got this kid upstairs, and it belonged to a drummer who played with a famous saxophone. It was a Gretsch kit, had a a 16 inch kick drum.
Uh-huh. Oh,
12 inch tom,
and a very jazz.
So that became my jazz kit. That's what I would use for those shows. And so that first gig that I had was playing in a jazz trio. It was piano, bass, and drums. We used to play at a restaurant called the Lobster Pot in Cleveland.
Nice.
And, you know, so I mean, that was
see me at the pot.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Hey, you know, come see this 16-year-old kid play at the pot.
Yeah.
Right. So I got this kit, and I couldn't find out much about it because years ago there was apparently a fire like in the Gretsch factory. So I called Gretsch, and because the serial numbers are, you know, inside the drums, and I, you know, gave them the serial numbers, and they got back to me and said, "We're sorry, but
there was a fire.
We can't, you know." So I know the kit is from the 60s, but I can't pinpoint what it is, but like I said, it's a great sounding kit, and I still have it. I was in Cleveland, and I was playing in a country band, and we were playing a club. It was the end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
We were packing up, and there was a patron sitting at the end of the bar who didn't want to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, kept asking for one more beer. Give me just one, you know.
And, yeah.
The bartender was getting frustrated. She kept asking him to leave. And he stood up and he said, "What are you going to do, shoot me?" And she took out a...
Oh no! Really?
Really. Took out a gun and shot him in the hip.
Uh-huh. Well, he guessed right, didn't he?
Right, yeah. Must have been a small caliber thing because it was like a little pop and he didn't fall down. And he just... He looked incredulously at her and was like, "You just shot me."
Yeah. Well, you asked me and right. I told you.
And yeah. And our manager at the time was like, "Okay, you guys, get out. I don't want you here."
Oh, yeah.
You know, when the police show up. So I don't know whatever ended up happening with
right.
it because we just got...
He didn't want to have to give testimony.
No, we just got
shuffled. Out of there.
We got just shuffled out.
You also do an amazing job with students in instruction, and you teach both piano and drums.
Correct.
Can you recall a student that really excelled, that did really well, that kind of took off? And
I started teaching piano when he was probably about 4 and a half.
Oh, wow.
And this...
That's young.
Yeah, young, but just picked up on it right away. And he loved music, and he taught himself guitar. He taught himself violin. His dad would bring home a trumpet. He'd learn how to play trumpet. I eventually also ended up teaching him drums as well.
Yeah.
And he would, you know, record his own stuff.
Right,
and
lay down the tracks.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he was a one-man band, and he could do it all. But he had a lot of other artistic interests as well. And I know he still does music for enjoyment.
Right.
But he also... paints, and so
wow,
you know, I
interesting guy.
Yeah, I find him. You know, we're friends on Facebook, so mm-hmm. I'll see a post from him every now and again.
Yeah, we got to be proud of that.
Yeah, yeah,
you had something to do with that.
The first school I went to was Miami University down in Oxford,
gotcha.
Ohio. And when I got there, I was enrolled in music education. Just mm-hmm. because I thought it would be, like I said, a good safety net.
Yeah.
However, I found out that if you're a music education major, you had to be in marching band. Well, I had to be in marching band when I was in high school and did it. Did not like it. Marching band was not my thing.
Yeah.
So I switched to performance.
Uh-huh.
Because if you're a performance major, you didn't have to be in marching band. And so then I spent 2 years there. I transferred to Berklee College of Music up in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
That's
a nice jump. Wow.
Well-known
school.
So then I ended up getting my music degree eventually from Cleveland State University. Didn't need it. Took me 10, 12 mm-hmm. years, you know, but mm-hmm. I just kind of wanted to do it for my own self-satisfaction. But I knew that I was not wired to be like a band director in a high school or
How did you know at that age that was not a good thing for you?
And I think I probably picked up on that probably as early as, you know, like junior high school band, and seeing what the band directors had to go through.
Yeah. Okay,
you know, and it's like, and to this day, you know, when I have friends who are middle school or high school band directors, and I say, God bless you, because, man.
I get it.
I could never do that.
Yeah. Tell me a story about when you're at Berklee.
So I had spent 2 years at Miami, which was a great experience. You know, I really enjoyed it down there. I had a great private instructor. His name was Bill Albin.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, you know, more geared towards, you know, you're analyzing Bach and it's that kind of stuff. And I was more interested in contemporary music. I mean, that was kind of my thing.
Gotcha.
So I auditioned for Berklee and was fortunate enough to get in. And probably learned more. I was only there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And probably learned more in that year
that
I had in the previous 2 years at Miami. And that's not to say anything negative about Miami. It was a great experience. But just for what I wanted to learn, the Berkeley experience was great because everyone there was a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone. So I had a teacher, saxophone player, Ed Tomasi, Brooklyn Italian guy, talked with the real thing.
Oh, yeah,
know,
yeah.
The real thing. You know, so he was one of my harmony teachers. So we're studying all this, you know, complex Bud Powell stuff and Charlie Parker stuff and, you know, all this. Yeah, right, exactly. Who's one of, in fact, I had a cat whose name was Yardbird that I named after Charlie Parker because he was such a big influence on me. But so we're learning all this complex stuff and I'll never forget it, you know. So one day after drawing, you know, this, analyzing this particular Bud Powell solo or something like that, he goes, okay, now that you've learned, you know, picture this thick Italian Brooklyn accent, you know, okay,
yeah,
okay, now that you've learned all that, forget all that and just play. You know, so okay, you learn everything and then it's like, okay, but the bottom line is go out and play.
Yeah.
You know,
pull it from the gut if you have to.
Right, you know, don't think about why you're playing, you know, E flat major 7 chord over. And you know, you're not thinking like that. You're just playing.
Yeah.
And boy, that just stuck with me. The Nashville Cowboy Church was a church that would meet on Sunday mornings in a bar.
Okay.
So,
cool.
And literally there would be nights where Saturday night I would be playing at this bar until 2 a.m.
Right.
And then I'd be back at 7 a.m.
Cleaned up
to play church.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know? And the pastor's wife was Joanne Cash, who was Johnny Cash's sister. It was only a pilot that was filmed for the Nashville Network, so it
pilots count.
That was a great experience because that led to me playing with Johnny Cash.
Oh, tell me about that.
This would have been 93, 94.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it came in one Sunday, wasn't expecting it. Johnny Cash was there with June Carter Cash.
As always.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the whole Carter family.
We ended up, you know, playing that service and playing songs with Johnny Cash. And, you know, it was an amazing experience for me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to play with one of my musical heroes. I love Johnny Cash before
that.
No,
I've heard he's a presence that when he enters a room, you just can't take your eyes off him. He's kind of like...
He is, but he is so humble. You know, the man in black, but for this thing, he wasn't all dressed up in his... normal.
He's a good God-fearing man after everything that's happened to him.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
Right. But it was great. I mean, he was just, you know, he's thanking us, you know, for playing with him. 2-3 weeks after that, I'm in a grocery store and he's there too. Because that's the way it is down in Nashville, right? I mean, you know, I came up to him and, you know, I said, you know, Mr. Cash, I don't know if you remember me. I you know, played drums with you at the Nashville Cowboy Church, you know, a couple weeks ago. And I know for a fact that he didn't remember me from Adam, but he said, oh, yeah, I remember. Great drummer. Yeah, it was great playing with you. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's just that's just the way he was.
When you were growing up, who was your greatest supporter in your family?
My parents were both very supportive. Both my parents were educators. My father worked for the Cleveland Public School District. He was a teacher, principal, then became an administrator. So he always supported me, but at the same time, was aware that, you know, you might need something to fall back on. So he would, you know, maybe throw me a book about education or something like that. Hey, you might want to read this, you know, just in case. But when I decided to go to music school, no one said, don't do it, that's foolish, do something that's gonna, you know. When I decided to move to Nashville, no one said, don't do it if this is something that you want to do and need to do. So there was always that support there, you know, concern like a parent would have to make sure that their kid is not going to be panhandling on the street, you know, playing buckets for, you know, money or something like that, right?
Who inspired you the most?
Well, having two older sisters and the music that they were listening to, I mean, there were a number of influences that inspired me, and but I would, you know, I probably would say Ringo Starr. You know, I mean, like a lot of people, you know, he really brought drumming to the forefront.
Exactly, he did.
And I mean, there were drummers before that that were, you know, I mean, a Gene Krupa, a Buddy Rich, you know, who were very prominent, visible drummers. But as far as kids, you're more listening to the rock and the pop stuff. And so Ringo was like it.
And I'm sure you've heard Ringo's stories and things like that, but he had that premier kit or drum kit. It wasn't very good. And when the Beatles, a larger degree of success, before they came to America, they asked him, you know, what would you like? He said, oh, I'd love a Ludwig kit.
Yeah.
He said, and I want my, you want your name on it? You know, because everybody was putting initials back on the drum heads back then. And they, and he said, oh, the Beatles. And so they designed the logo. And then, you know, he's got the drum kit, you know, with the cymbal sizzlers, I think he had for the ride cymbal.
He might have. Yeah, I'm not sure.
One of those early tracks, it was a lot of
right,
with no hi-hat going. So they asked Ringo what he thought of Buddy Rich. Now, these are two totally different types of drummers.
Right.
You know, sounds like he's got rats running around his kit. And I thought about that for a while. That it was one of Buddy Rich's drum solos, and sounds like there's rats running around the kit. Drives you these days?
The main thing that drives me is the fact that I get to do this for my living. There's not a day that goes by that I take that for granted. You know, I feel very blessed.
Isn't that great? It is true. Yeah.
I mean, my mantra has always been, you know, the worst day of playing music beats the best day of doing anything else.
I remember our band in high school, going way back.
Yeah.
A band that played out places, and we had gotten a job at a VFW, and when we showed up in the corner, they said, you can put your drums in the corner, and there was a piece of carpet that was about the size of, like, it was like 5 feet by 5 feet. Well, it wasn't going to fit in there. And they go, well, everybody else that comes in, their drum kit fits in there. And okay, well, we took up a lot of space, as it turns out. And then as we're setting up, we blew fuses. Just plugging in and turning on, we blew fuses. So we're running cords everywhere. Then people were coming in, and they didn't want to hear the music that we were playing.
Mm-hmm.
So they were more probably country, late 50s, mid 60s country, even though this was in the late 70s, because we weren't playing country music as a band. We had played some country music just for fun at practice.
Yeah.
We started playing those jams, and everybody came out of the bar and danced, and the dance floor filled, and we were playing nothing. We were just jamming in a country flavored twang.
Very, very similar story. So I had a band here in Chicago, and we were mostly an original band playing like power pop stuff. So we were big influenced by, like, you know, the Raspberries and, you know, that kind of a sound. And so we were playing a club in McHenry.
Okay.
And it was mostly like bikers and, you know, so we come out and we're playing this, you know, jangly power pop kind of stuff, you know,
strings up.
And it's like, you're right. Exactly. Yeah. Totally. Yeah, yeah, exactly like that. And we're not getting a good response. You know, we're thinking these guys are going to break out chains, you know. The guitar player who was fronting our band just started playing the riff to Taking Care of Business by Bachman Turner Overdrive. Mm-hmm. And everyone all of a sudden turned their heads and like, okay, that's something they recognize. And from that point on, we just started playing rock tunes that we had never played before.
Aimed in that direction.
and they loved us by the end of the night, you know. But you know, it's like, okay, that's adjusting on the fly. We used to call it the Chuck Berry rule. What would Chuck Berry do?
Yeah.
You know, he'd go this direction, he'd go that, you know, so that's what we used to always call it, the Chuck Berry rule.
pretty cool. Great story though.
If you know, 10 years physically, if I'm still able to, you know, do this on this level, this is what I would like to be doing, is still playing music. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's what I do. It's what I've always done. So I really can't imagine myself doing anything else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the kind of job that you can do, you know, I mean, pretty much up until, you know,
exactly,
you go. I mean, there's a
and what a way to go.
Yeah absolutely.
So if you could travel back in time to say, like, you're 12 years old, you could talk to yourself, what would you tell yourself at 12 years old?
We get such a small amount of time on this planet. You
exactly,
know, we're here for a blink of an eye, but just to enjoy it and not take anything for granted, because it could be gone tomorrow.
Absolutely, could be gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, Robert, thank you for coming today.
Paul, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me. The worst day of playing music beats the best day of doing anything else.
Yeah. Musician and teacher Robert Brose is indeed a one-of-a-kind type of guy. After our podcast and after our interview, I firmly believe that besides music, life is Robert's work of art. And he spends each day making, every day, new and one of a kind. Pretty good. For Life's Learning Curve, I'm Paul Hart.
Life's Learning Curve podcast is put together by producer Paul Hart, with assistance by Gail Varma, Brian Spees, and ST Dog. We're mixed by Jack Lodge, technical director Randy Blanken. As always, music and audio assistance by Riley Hart. Visit our website, lifeslearningcurve.buzzsprout.com. Special thanks to our guest, Robert Brose. Check out his website, robertbrose.com. As always, don't forget to choose the like on Facebook and find us again where you're listening right now, including newly added iHeartRadio. I'm Paul Hart, and we will be back with more stories from Life's Learning Curve.